Tanto Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Underworld, The Mysterious Origins of Civilization by Graham Hancock. Narrated by Dennis Kleinman. Part 1. Initiation. 1. Relics. If you do not expect it, you will not find the unexpected, for it is hard to find and difficult. Heraclitus. 5 kilometers off the southeast coast of India, submerged at a depth of 23 meters beneath the murky, shark-infested waters of the Bay of Bengal, an ancient man-made structure sits on the bottom of the sea. The structure is U-shaped, like a huge horseshoe. Its periphery measures 85 meters, and its walls are about 1 meter thick and 2 meters high. The discovery was made by a team of marine archaeologists from India's National Institute of Oceanography, NIO, in March 1991, working offshore of the Tranquebar-Pumpuhar coast of Tamil Nadu, near Nagapattinam. Their equipment included side-scan sonar, which transmits an acoustic signal up to 1,000 meters wide and measures the strength of the returning echo. Towed behind a research vessel, side-scan sonar is capable of building accurate maps of seabed contours and of identifying any obvious anomalies such as shipwrecks. On 7 March 1991, a shipwreck at a depth of 19 meters was pinpointed by the sonar. It was investigated by divers on 8 and 9 March, who found many scattered objects, including lead ingots and iron cannon, on the surrounding seabed. The official report of the project then states, "Till 1 p.m. on 9 March, the divers were working on the scattered objects. T.C.S. Rao, who was carrying out sonar survey 5 kilometers opposite Chinnavanagiri, not far from the wreck, reported another object 40 by 10 meters having the shape of a ship recorded on sonograph. Sri Bandotkar was sent to the site designated PMR-2, and he placed 2 marker buoys there. By 2 p.m., Manavi and Chini dived, but as the buoys had drifted, the object could not be explored." A second side-scan sonar survey later in the afternoon refined the measurements, suggesting that the object was oval and measured 30 to 35 meters east to west and 10 meters north to south, with an apparent opening on one side. On 16 and 19 March, T.C.S. Rao continued the survey and now reported, "There are actually 3 objects, the central one being oval-shaped with an opening on the northern side. Its longer axis is 20 meters. There is a clay deposit on the eastern flank, beyond which another semicircular structure is seen. To the northwest of the central object, 1 or more oval-shaped objects are found." Finally, on 23 March 1991, 3 divers were able to go down, but only had sufficient air to study the central structure. The official report describes what they saw as follows: a horseshoe-shaped object, its height being 1 or 2 meters. A few stone blocks were found in the 1 meter wide arm. The distance between the 2 arms is 20 meters. Whether the object is a shrine or some other man-made structure, now at 23 meters depth, remains to be examined in the next field season. Deep can mean very old. In the event no work could be done at the site in the next season, but in 1993, the structure was examined again by the NIO's diver archaeologists, who took careful measurements and eventually reported their findings as follows. The structure of U-shape was located at a water depth of 23 meters, which is about 5 kilometers offshore. The total peripheral length of the object is 85 meters, while the distance between the 2 arms is 13 meters, and the maximum height is 2 meters. The height of the eastern arm is greater than that of the western arm. The center of the object is covered with sediment, but some patches of rock were noticed. Hand fanning showed that the central part of the object is rocky at a depth of 10 to 15 centimeters. Divers observed growth of thick marine organism on the structure, but in some sections a few courses of masonry were noted. Since 1993, for want of funding, no further marine archaeology has been conducted along the Pumpuhar coast, and the general impression has been disseminated in archaeological literature that the NIO has not found any submerged structures there that are older than the 3rd century BC. This is certainly true of numerous structures that were excavated very near to the shore, usually in depths of less than 2 meters of water, and often half exposed at low tide. But the U-shaped structure at 23 meters, more than 70 feet, is another matter altogether, and cannot by any means be automatically assigned to the 3rd century BC. On the contrary, since we know that the sea level has been continuously rising during the last 19,000 years, common sense suggests that structures now submerged by 23 meters of water must be much older than structures in just 2 meters. Nobody has looked. In February 2000, I travelled to Bangalore to the home of the doyen of India's marine archaeologists, S. R. Rao, founder of the Marine Archaeology Centre at the NIO and the man who had led the Tranquebar Pumpahar survey. Rao is a distinguished, lean-faced man in his mid-70s with boundless energy and enthusiasm for his subject. After the pleasantries were over, I told him that I was intrigued by the U-shaped structure his team had found at Pumpahar. 23 meters is deep. Doesn't that mean that it could be very old? Correct, definitely, Rao replied. That is what we are also thinking. In fact, we took our ocean engineer also to see whether the structure had gone down as a result of erosion by the sea or by its own weight. I don't think that is the case, because it is a huge structure which has been built at that depth. At that time, the sea was further out. This was built when it was above water. Then does the sea rise so much within such a short period was the question, 23 meters, just within 2,000 years or so. Maybe the sea level rise that covered this structure took place a lot earlier than that, I offered. Maybe it belongs to a much earlier period than the 2,000-year-old ruins of Pumpahar in the intertidal zone. There have been sea level rises that could have done something like this, but they took place a long time ago, at the end of the Ice Age. Correct. At that time it happened. You are correct. There were 3 large floods at the end of the Ice Age, and even the most recent of these takes us back 8,000 years. Is that a possible date for the U-shaped structure? We don't know, Rao replied, because you see, from whatever we have got, we are not able to decide its date at all. Why is that? Because amongst the samples we took, we found no organic materials that could be dated by carbon-14, and no pottery that could be dated by thermoluminescence or by type. We have only stone which cannot be dated in any meaningful sense. Except by one factor, which is that the structure is now under 23 meters of water. So the sea level rise itself can be helpful in indicating a date. Correct. I do know that for the Gulf of Kutch in northwestern India, an oceanographic study has been made, and the oceanographers themselves have said that at 10,000 BC, the sea level was 60 meters lower than it is today. If that is true there, it is also true here. Which raises the possibility that we may be looking at remnants of a previously unknown ancient culture. Ancient, definitely, Rao exclaimed. And, in fact, where really was the origin of India's earliest known civilization, the Indus Valley Civilization? Scholars guess, but nobody knows. The Indus Valley script itself is already a highly developed script when it first appears in the 3rd millennium BC. The early architecture is already developed. You have got brick structures, you have got drains, everything is planned and all that. So there must be something before that. Where is the evolutionary phase? We don't know. Dr. Rao was getting close to the real reason that I had come to see him. Maybe the evidence of the evolutionary phase is underwater, I suggested. It's underwater? Quite possible. If so, then this underwater structure at Pumpahar could be incredibly important, simply because of its depth. 23 meters. 23 meters. That's right. Now, if we can rule out land subsidence, and further work must be done before we can rule that out, but if we can rule that out, and if it's an issue exclusively of sea level rise, Then we have a discovery here that calls into question the accepted chronology of civilization. Rao pondered for a moment before replying. You see, some people, some traditions, do say that there was a continent in the Indian Ocean a very long time ago, more than 10,000 years ago, that got submerged. Quite possible. You see, we are not doing thorough research. If we had taken more time and more funds and all that, perhaps we could find many more structures, not only that one, and then you could come to some kind of conclusion about the much earlier epoch. I told Rao that I was familiar with the South Indian traditions to which he was referring. These describe extensive lands, submerged about 11,000 years ago, that had once existed in the Indian Ocean to the south of the present Cape Comorin. The name of these lost lands was Kumari Kandam. At the time of their inundation, the traditions say, they had been the home of a high civilization that had even boasted an academy of advanced learning, where philosophy and literature were cultivated. It must have existed, Rao asserted. You can't rule that out at all, particularly, as I've said, since we have found this structure at 23-meter depth. I mean, we have photographed it. It is there. Anybody can go and see. I do not believe that it is an isolated structure. Further exploration is likely to reveal others round about, and then you can go deeper, you see, and you may get more important things. I asked if there had been any further attempt since 1993 to find underwater structures off southern India. No, Rao replied. Nobody has looked. Ken Shindo's story. In 1996, 4 years before my meeting with Rao, my book Fingerprints of the Gods became the number one bestseller in Japan, a country that had fascinated me since childhood. The book's success gave me my first opportunity to travel there. I visited Japan twice that year to give a series of public lectures about the issues I'd explored in Fingerprints of the Gods. On the second visit, I was approached after a lecture by a photojournalist named Ken Shindo, who works for the influential Kyodo Tsushin News Agency. He showed me striking underwater pictures that he had taken of a bizarre terraced structure, apparently a man-made monument of some kind, lying at depths of up to 30 meters off the south coast of the Japanese island of Yonaguni. My central research and writing interest for years has been the possibility of a lost civilization destroyed in the cataclysmic global floods that brought the last ice age to an end. So I was immediately fascinated by Shindo's story. An underwater ruin here in Japan, I exclaimed. Is it definitely man-made? Shindo laughed. Some people say it's a freak of nature, but they haven't spent time on it like I have. I'm absolutely certain it's man-made. Does anyone know how old it is? Shindo told me that he had been working with Professor Masaki Kimura, a marine seismologist at the University of the Ryukyus, Okinawa, who had been studying Yonaguni's mysterious underwater structures since 1994. Kimura, too, was convinced it was man-made. His extensive surveys, sampling, and measurement had shown that it had been hewn out of solid bedrock when the site was still above water. If sea level rise were the only factor to take into account, then provisional calculations would indicate a date of inundation of around 10,000 years ago. That's approximately 5,000 years older than the oldest known monumental buildings on Earth, the ziggurats of ancient Sumer in Mesopotamia. Davy Jones's Locker. I knew that I had to learn to dive and talked my wife Santha into doing lessons with me when we were on a visit to Los Angeles. We took our paddy open water courses in the chill kelpie waters of Catalina Island in November 1996. My first reaction to diving was that it was a weird and scary experience, contrary to the laws of nature, and that I was unlikely to survive it. I was wrapped up like the Michelin man in a full-body neoprene wetsuit, and there seemed to be a ludicrous amount of equipment strapped, velcroed, or clipped onto me. Let's start at the feet. Here the diver wears short rubber boots tucked inside the ankle cuffs of his wetsuit. The wetsuit works by taking in a thin layer of water between the skin and the suit, This is rapidly warmed to body temperature and remains warm for some time because the neoprene of the suit is an excellent insulator. Over the boots are strapped the diver's fins, without which he would be almost as clumsy and immobile submerged as he is on land with all his gear on, and would unnecessarily waste a great deal of energy thrashing about. Strapped to his calf, there should be a strong stainless steel knife with a sharp blade. This can be life-saving if you get caught up in a drifting fish net or some other equally uncompromising, usually man-made hazard. Around the diver's waist is a belt through which are threaded a number of lead weights to compensate for the natural buoyancy of the body and the additional buoyancy of the wetsuit. These days, I can often get away with 2 kilos, but inexperienced divers need a lot more. On my first dives back in 1996 and into the first half of 1997, I remember having to use 12 and in one case even 14 kilos, a horrendous load. Moving on up the body, the next item of equipment the diver wears is a partially inflatable sleeveless jacket called a buoyancy control device, BCD, or just BC for short. The scuba tank, which provides the diver with air to breathe underwater, is strapped onto the back of the BC and typically comes in 10, 12, and 15 litre sizes. A mid-sized tank weighs more than 15 kilos, and for most dives is filled with nothing other than normal air under enormous compression. This is delivered to the diver through 2 transformers which step down the pressure of the air to a level where it can be breathed easily. The first stage is mounted immediately on top of the tank and removes most of the pressure. From here, a rubber hose leads to the second stage, or regulator, which is placed in the diver's mouth and provides air on demand. 3 other rubber hoses also emerge from the first stage. One of these connects to the BC, allowing the diver to power inflate it direct from the tank. One leads to a dangling instrument console, usually containing a compass and gauges that tell you how much air you have left and how deep you are. The last, called the octopus, is a spare second stage for use in emergencies, for example, to provide air to another diver whose own tank is empty. Sometimes divers wear a rubber hood, since heat loss from the unprotected head is very rapid. A glass-fronted mask, without which the human eye can only perceive blurred images underwater, covers the eyes and nose. The final major pieces of equipment are a small wrist computer, which can save your life by warning you if you are ascending too fast from depth, and a pair of gloves to keep your hands warm and prevent grazing or accidental contact with unpleasant marine organisms like fire coral. Wrapped up in all this stuff, with our total scuba experience at that time amounting to just 3.5 hours swimming pool dives each, Santha and I contemplated the waters of the Pacific with certain misgivings. To be honest, we were afraid. It looked deep and dark and dangerous down there, down amongst the waving streamers of kelp, down in Davy Jones's locker. But if we wanted to see that incredible underwater structure in Japan for ourselves, then we were going to have to do this. On our instructor's command, we jumped in and paddled out from shore. 4 days later, we were licensed, but definitely not yet experienced enough to dive at Yonaguni. A generous offer. I did not know when we would be able to organize a diving trip to Japan, but knew only that it would be expensive. Then a strange synchronicity occurred. Out of the blue, sometime in January 1997, I received a fax from an American company representing a Japanese businessman. The fax said that the businessman had read Fingerprints of the Gods and would like to invite Santha and me to fly first class to Yonaguni at his expense to explore the island and to dive at the monument. He would ensure our safety by sending a group of top-flight diving instructors with us from the Seaman's Club, a hotel and dive school on the neighboring island of Ishigaki. He would also provide us with a fully equipped dive boat and all other facilities. There were no strings attached to this generous offer, which we accepted. In March 1997, we flew from London to Tokyo and then via Okinawa to Yonaguni to do our first dives there. This was the beginning of a long-term friendship with the businessman, whose privacy I protect, and of what began as an informal project to explore, document, and try to understand the sequence of ancient and highly anomalous structures that have been found underwater at Yonaguni and at other islands in southwest Japan. Yonaguni. The first anomalous structure that was discovered at Yonaguni lies below glowering cliffs of the southern shore of the island. Local divers call it Iseki Point, Monument Point. Into its south face, at a depth of about 18 meters, an area of terracing with conspicuous flat planes and right angles has been cut. Two huge parallel blocks weighing approximately 30 tons each and separated by a gap of less than 10 centimeters have been placed upright side by side at its northwest corner. In about 5 meters of water at the very top of the structure, there is a kidney-shaped pool, and nearby is a feature that many divers believe is a crude rock-carved image of a turtle. At the base of the monument, in 27 meters of water, there is a clearly defined stone-paved path oriented toward the east. If the diver follows this path, a relatively easy task, since there is often a strong west-to-east current here, he will come in a few hundred meters to the megalith, a rounded 2-ton boulder that seems to have been purposely placed on a carved ledge at the center of a huge stone platform. 2 kilometers west of Iseki Point is the palace. Here, an underwater passageway leads into the northern end of a spacious chamber with megalithic walls and ceiling. At the southern end of the chamber, a tall lintel doorway leads into a second, smaller chamber beyond. At the end of that chamber is a vertical rock-hewn shaft that emerges outside on the roof of the palace. Nearby, a flat rock bears a pattern of strange deep grooves. A little further east, there is a second megalithic passage roofed by a gigantic slab that fits snugly against the tops of the supporting walls. 2 kilometers to the east of Iseki Point is Tatagami Iwa, literally the Standing God Stone, a natural pinnacle of rugged black rock that soars up out of the ocean. At its base, 18 meters underwater, there is a horizontal tunnel barely wide enough to fit a diver that runs perfectly straight west to east and emerges amidst a scatter of large blocks with clean-cut edges. A 3-minute swim to the southeast brings the diver to what looks like an extensive ceremonial complex carved out of stone. Here at depths of 15 to 25 meters, there are massive rectilinear structures with sheer walls separated by wide avenues. At the center is the monument that local divers refer to as the Stone Stage. Into its south-facing corner, either man or nature has carved an image that looks to some like a gigantic anthropoid face, with 2 clearly marked eyes. Karama. At Aka Island in the Karama Group, 40 kilometers west of Okinawa, local divers have been aware for some years of the existence of a series of underwater stone circles at depths of 30 meters. There are also associated rectilinear formations within the same general area that show some signs of having been cut and worked by human beings. Diving conditions at Karama are atrociously difficult, as indeed they are often at Yonaguni too. There is a killer current, but this drops away almost to nothing for approximately an hour between tides. Only in that lull is it possible to get any serious work done and to gain a perspective on the enigmatic structures without constantly having to fight against the sea. Karama's most spectacular feature is Center Circle, which has a diameter of approximately 20 meters and a maximum depth of 27 meters. Here, concentric rings of upright megaliths more than 3 meters tall have been hewn out of the bedrock surrounding a central menhir. A second similar circle, called Small Center Circle by local divers, stands immediately to the northeast. It is not noticeably smaller than the first. A little to the south is Stone Circle, which is made up of much smaller rounded stones. It has a huge diameter of about 150 meters. Within it are subsidiary stone circles, sometimes touching one another at their edges like the links of a chain. Aguni. Aguni Island, 60 kilometers north of Karama, has steep and forbidding cliffs. On the southwest side of the island, these cliffs overlook an area of turbulent water that local fishermen call the washing machine. The turbulence is caused by the presence of a seamount that ascends from much greater depths to form a small plateau only 4 meters under the surface. This plateau, perpetually swept by strong currents, contains a series of circular holes that look initially like well shafts. As they are lined with small blocks, there is little doubt that these shafts are man-made. The largest and deepest has a diameter of 3 meters and reaches a maximum depth below the summit of the seamount of about 10 meters. Others are typically 2 to 3 meters in diameter with a depth of less than 7 meters. A few are narrower and shallower. One has a small subsidiary chamber cut sideways into the wall of the main shaft. Chatan. The coastline around Okinawa has been the subject of intense development during the past half century. 30 kilometers north of the capital, Naha, on the west coast of the island, is the popular resort area of Chatan. Here, less than a kilometer offshore, at depths of between 10 and 30 meters, is strewn a looming underwater fantasia of walls and battlements and step pyramids. Are these weird submerged structures natural or man-made? And if they are man-made, then when and by whom? One possibility suggested to me by local fishermen is that the structures could be artifacts of relatively recent military dredging. Certainly, several large U.S. Air Force bases are located very close to Chatan, and the site is constantly overflown by all kinds of American warplanes doing maneuvers. I still remain open to the possibility that dredging could have produced some of the features to be seen underwater. But against this, I have received a report from Akira Suzuki, a Japanese historical researcher who has carefully investigated both U.S. and Japanese archives in Okinawa and has been unable to find any record of such operations in this area. The most striking of the Chatan structures is a wall with its base on the sandy bottom at a depth of 30 meters. It rises to a battlement with a sunken walkway about 10 meters above the seabed. At a certain point, the walkway is broken by a vertical U-shaped shaft cut through the entire height of the wall. To dive at Chatan is to be reminded of an episode in the Nihongi, one of Japan's most ancient texts, a chronicle of the earliest times. Here, in a long introductory section entitled The Age of the Gods, there is a passage that describes how a deity named Hohodemi no Mikoto climbed into an upended waterproof basket and descended to the bottom of the sea. In this makeshift submarine, he found himself at a pleasant strand. Proceeding on his way, he suddenly arrived at the palace of the sea god. This palace was provided with battlements and turrets and had stately towers. No doubt the many curious things that the Nihongi has to say about the age of the gods may all be explained as mythology and imagination. Still, I find it curious in Japan, where there are so many underwater anomalies, that such a venerable ancient text contains a clear tradition of submerged structures that can only be visited by divers. 15,000 years. Between 1996 and 2000, while I increased my practical diving experience of Japan's underwater ruins, I several times got caught up in the virulent debate about their provenance. Some scholars and journalists think they are entirely natural or mostly natural, Robert Shark of Boston University, for example. Others, such as Professor Kimura and Professor Teruaki Ishii of Tokyo University, remain convinced that they are man-made, but are uncertain as to their antiquity. In addition to sea level rise, complex factors such as possible land subsidence through volcanism, plastic flow, or isostatic rebound must be taken into account when determining the date of submergence of any given site. No early resolution of this debate can be expected, since we are dealing here as much with matters of opinion as with matters of generally agreed fact. Those who think the structures are natural are likely to go on thinking so no matter what the other side says, and vice versa. It looks like a stalemate. Yet there is a potentially fruitful line of inquiry, capable of shedding light on this problem, which neither side has yet considered. Whether they were flooded by rising sea levels or because of some form of land subsidence into the sea.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?